This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Each year, young people head off to college. For many students, college will be a rewarding experience. They'll receive a good education, and their lives will be forever enriched. But others will face difficulties. They may leave before earning a degree, or they may get that degree but feel college wasn't all it might have been. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, how students can make the most of college. Our guest is Richard Light. He is a professor in the Graduate School of Education and the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Richard Light is also the author of Making the Most of College, Students Speak Out. Professor Light has interviewed hundreds of students over the course of a decade to learn what they have to say about their experiences in school. Listeners, if you have a child in college or soon to enter college, if you're a student, a teacher, or other member of the university community, I hope you'll join the discussion with your comments and questions. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Making the Most of College is published by the Harvard University Press. Professor Light, good afternoon. Welcome.
Yes, good afternoon, Celeste. I'm very pleased to join you.
I'm pleased to have you as our guest this afternoon. Back in 1986, Harvard began to look at the quality of experiences students were having at Harvard. What led Harvard to begin such an examination?
Well, let me tell you exactly how it began, and I'll try to make a long story short. I've taught here at Harvard for about 30 years, basically my whole adult life. And in 1986, as you just said, our then president here at the university, his name was Derek Bach, he simply called and said, "Now, Dick, you teach research methods, statistics, especially in education. How well are we doing? Can you do an assessment, an evaluation, working together with many colleagues and indeed perhaps working with some undergraduates, some students as well? Can you determine, can you evaluate what are we doing well and what are we doing not so well? Are we teaching students as well as we could here at our campus and indeed how about other campuses? Are we advising students? Are we giving them wise advice when they first arrive here on college about how to spend their time, about course selection?" And he also asked lots of questions about quality of life. As a result, just to set the background, I gathered together about 30 colleagues, 30 colleagues here at Harvard, and also about 35 from 20 or so other campuses. We met regularly, and we interviewed 1,600 students. That's one heck of a big number. In depth, one-on-one, real personal and up close, to get a sense of what their experience had been and what can colleges do better.
I think it's great that you went right to the students and asked them, you know, what their experiences had been like.
Well, you're kind to say that. You know, one of the things we as a group, and again, I said 30 from Harvard and another 30 or more than 30 from other campuses, so we had over 60 people meeting regularly every month, and one of the first questions we asked ourselves, again, put yourself in our shoes, and I invite your listeners to put themselves in our shoes. Here we are, a bunch of mostly middle-aged folks sitting around asking one another, well, how do we determine, how do we figure out what we're doing well and what we're doing perhaps not so well, and maybe how can we tinker and do it a little better? Well, what better way than to ask the students rather than have a bunch of middle-aged folks speculating, guessing, and wondering?
What was the most surprising thing you discovered?
I think probably if I had to choose a single thing, Celeste, it would be that I expected students to want most campus leaders, whether it's professors or advisors or the deans or the president or whoever, you know, whoever runs the campuses, I expected students to want those, shall I use the word adults, to kind of get out of their way. And, you know, I expected the students to say, look, I'm an adult, I'm 18, I'm 20, maybe I'm much older than that. Get out of my way, let me just make the most of my experience. I was wrong. It turns out that most students, both on my campus and on many, many dozens of other campuses, want more advice, more guidance. In other words, they want the adults, the leaders on campus to, shall I quote, say, quote, to get in their way, unquote. I didn't expect that.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because it was interesting to me to read that in the chapter that is Faculty Who Make a Difference, it begins, when asked to estimate their own impact on students, more than a few of my faculty colleagues rate it as modest. But if you go to any student and ask them, of course, the answer is, well, professors are very important. So are advisors, so are mentors.
You know, yes. I think often professors, faculty members, teachers, and I might add it, this is now a guess, but I think I'm probably guessing right. It's high school teachers as well as college faculty and college teachers and professors. We all tend to underestimate the impact that we can have on students. One young woman told me an especially powerful and very short anecdote. She said, for many, many years, I believed a certain thing about education reform. I won't go into every little detail of what this woman said, but the punchline just was, she said, my professor, happened to be another woman, pressed me for evidence to back up my position. And the young woman reported and said, this professor changed the way I think about almost everything now. I'm always asking, where's the evidence? Where's the data? Where's the information? It's too easy to just say, spend more on this or spend less on that. Spend more on education, spend less on defense. Or spend more on defense, spend less on education. Question is, what will the impacts be? In other words, professors can really help students to become much more analytic and rigorous in their thinking, and that's regardless of the student's substantive field or interests.
Yeah. So that is one of the things that's happening in a solid interaction between professors and students, that there's some challenging going on.
There is indeed. Would you like me to share with you one of my favorite examples?
Sure.
This happens to be from a young woman. I've got plenty of stories from men, but this one's from a young woman. I think she was a junior about to become a senior. And I asked, what was the most powerful course, the course that had the biggest impact on you that you've taken in your several years here at college? She took my question very, very seriously. And she took this whole process seriously, and she thought and thought, must have been quiet for 15 seconds. Then she finally said, oh, Professor Light, now I know exactly what it was. It was my seminar in government policy. And I remember her name is Anne. I remember saying, Anne, can you give me an example of specifically why it had such a big impact on you? And she said, well, you wouldn't believe what the professor did. This was one of those luxurious seminars where there were only 12 of us in it. And we met once a week for 3 hours. So 1 week, the professor gave us the assignment that next week we're going to discuss the pros and the cons of rent control in congested urban areas. And she went on to say, the professor then took the 12 of us and assigned, didn't ask us which, do we favor rent control or not. The professor simply assigned 6 of us to next week, our homework assignment was, argue rigorously using evidence the case for rent control. The other 6 students in the class were given the assignment, now you're going to argue the case against. Well, the woman said, needless to say, we busted our backs. We worked so hard that next week we prepared individually, in groups. We didn't want to embarrass ourselves. We wanted to do a good job. The class discussion was vigorous as could be. And then she said, you know what really blew my mind? And I said, no, what blew your mind, Anne? And she said, at the end of the class, the professor commented, it was a great discussion, and now here's our homework assignment for the following week. The 6 of you who had just argued the case for rent control, your assignment is to do a 5-page summary paper arguing the case against rent control. And for the 6 of you who had argued against, you write a paper arguing for. As young Anne looked at me with a big smile and said, what do you think? Wasn't that a great learning experience? She was just beaming.
I suppose part of the experience of college is putting oneself in a whole different set of circumstances, whether it's in the classroom and hypothetical situations, whether it's hypothetical real-world situations, or whether it's just learning to live and to live with and get to know other people. That's what the college experience is in large part about, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is indeed. And you commented, if I can just particularly focus on and emphasize the last part of what you just said about learning to live with other people and very different people. One of the things that has been striking to me, perhaps it's because of my age, I'm in my late 50s, I've noticed the dramatic change, just changes in who attends college now, as we have our, you know, year 2002, compared with when I was in college in the 1960s. It really is very, very different. For instance, here where I teach at Harvard, 62% of the students are white, like me, and the other 38% are so-called, whether one loves these choice of words or not, students of color, to use the current term, and, you know, minority students. And that's so different from when I went to school. A lot of the interviews that my colleagues and I did and that the undergraduate interviewers asked, you know, students who were interviewing other students, in-depth, well-trained students who interviewed one another, they asked about the experiences that their fellow students were having because campus now, the campuses now bring together students from such different backgrounds. It turns out that the mixing and the mingling among students from different backgrounds is one of the most powerful experiences many students have.
How do students talk about this diversity? Do they value it?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I realize, I'm guessing that for most of us, including most of your listeners, most everyone brings their own perspective and slight biases in one direction or another to answer your question, Celeste. I know I tried very hard to just come at this without any preconceptions and just say, look, I'm just going to listen very carefully to what the students say. What I found is just about every undergraduate at my college, and I must add, at many, many other colleges, because I visited many. I was just, you know, at Bryn Mawr yesterday, and Loyola Chicago a few weeks ago, and Notre Dame. I'm just on and on around the country gathering data and chatting with students. One of the things I see is that almost any student of any race and ethnicity can tell two or three very happy, and shall I use the word uplifting, stories about how the racial and ethnic diversity on campus these days has benefited them and how they've enjoyed it and benefited from it. I might add, it's not hard when I say, now tell me one awkward moment, one unpleasant encounter. No one has any trouble thinking of any.
Hmm. Are students coming to Harvard prepared for the diversity of campus life?
You know, that's actually a very complicated question, and let me try to give what I think is the big punchline. I think they are prepared for it, but Harvard being Harvard, and I don't want to, you know, make a sales pitch for Harvard, I don't need to do that. This place being what it is, simply because it is as selective as it is, and I think this is true of many other campuses as well, both public and private, you know, large universities, state universities, private universities. Any campus that's selective can afford to take the students who tend to be a little bit thoughtful about this point of diversity. Nonetheless, there are some demographic facts, if I may use that word demographic, and that is that most students who come to any college have grown up in relatively homogeneous communities. There are heterogeneous mixed communities, but not that many. Most middle-class white kids grow up in middle-class white neighborhoods. Most, you know, I don't know, middle-class, or maybe it's lower-income, say, Latino kids, probably tended to grow up surrounded by lower-income folks, too. So for college, meeting these new folks is, on one hand, an exciting experience. On the other hand, it can be a jarring experience.
You mentioned Loyola and Bryn Mawr just a moment or two ago. And then, of course, we've been talking overall about Harvard and the experience there. I wonder if you've been to other campuses, if you've been to public university campuses, and if you could, if you have anything to say about the job that public universities are doing in terms of helping students deal with issues of diversity on campus?
Sure, I'd be very happy to. Yes, the answer is I've been to quite a lot of public universities. Here nearby me, you know, here Harvard is in Massachusetts, as I assume most of your listeners well know. I've been out to the University of Massachusetts, their flagship campus, if that's, again, the right choice of words. Their main campus is out in Amherst, and there's a smaller campus in a town called Dartmouth, Massachusetts, which is very different from, you know, the famous Dartmouth College, which is in a different state, New Hampshire. So the point is, it's our local public university. And then I've been all the way on the other side of the country, to the University of Washington up in Seattle. That's about as different from, let's say, a Bryn Mawr or a Loyola as you can get, because as you point out, and of course you're right, the Bryn Mawr is small and private. Loyola is, well, relatively small and private. And the University of Washington has 32,000 undergraduates, and it's public. The answer, I think, Celeste, you asked specifically about diversity. I know out at Seattle, at the University of Washington, the whole point of my visit, and I spent 4 days with them, the whole point of my visit, and they've had other visitors, I'm not the only person, was to not only meet with students, but to meet with and work with their faculty and their leaders, just to facilitate the way they might think about taking leadership, so that the students who do come from diverse backgrounds, I think they have something approaching 28 or 30% minority students there, minority kids, how can they help their students of all races and ethnicities to, again, quote, make the most of college and make the most of the diversity?
Yeah, because not only are there differences in color, but here on the campus of the University of Illinois, the differences between between students coming from a whole different kinds of backgrounds as far as religion goes is quite impressive. I mean, within walking distance, you can find a mosque, synagogue, many, many churches, Christian churches, Christian student unions, Baptist student union, Catholic, Roman Catholic student union, and the like. There's also a lot of diversity here at the University of Illinois in terms of students who are coming from a very urban background and students who are coming from a very rural background. That said, what are universities doing specifically to help students feel both at ease with and stimulated by others who are different than they are?
Sure. I'm going to try to give two different answers that really are quite different to your question because, again, these many visits to campus, first they confirm what you've just said about the university in Champaign-Urbana, and the description that you just gave with the synagogue near the church, near the mosque, next near the temple, and so on, that's of course true in so many areas and so many other universities, especially larger universities. One of the things that the leaders of many campuses, larger, smaller, public, private, more selective, less selective, campus leaders are doing increasingly is openly discussing, for example, when they welcome new students. Well, you want to be real specific. On my campus, there's an orientation period of several days before classes begin. I don't want to pretend to be an expert, on the University of Illinois, but I'm guessing there's an orientation. I don't know details. Mm-hmm. I assume there are a couple of days students come before classes start. They don't come the Sunday night, you know, as first-year new arrivals and, you know, start classes at 8 a.m. on Monday. I assume they come 2, 3, 4 days ahead. I'm no doubt they do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what can campus leaders do? Well, let me share with you, on my campus, we do two very specific things, and I know many other campuses do their version of these same two things. The first thing is to have campus leaders say over and over to the students as a full group. In other words, imagine at the University of Illinois, you had all the first-year students gathered, and there may be several thousands of people sitting in a large theater or whatever it is, and a dean or whoever welcomes them would say something along the lines of, you have a wonderful opportunity in your next few years here at college, here at the university, to get to know a group of people, one at a time, as individuals, who may be incredibly different from anyone you have ever known before you came here. Each of you, you wonderful new students who we welcome so warmly, has a choice. You can make an effort to proactively reach out and warmly embrace this opportunity to meet new people, people unlike any you've known before, very different from the folks you went to high school with, or you could choose to immediately find people who are just like you and kind of replicate your high school experience. You know, if you're a white middle-class guy, you can surround yourself with 30 other white middle-class guys. If you're a black middle-class guy, you can immediately run and join a black fraternity, the Black Students Association, and the Black Singing Group. Well, it's your choice, say most of the leaders here, but I strongly urge you to reach out and meet others. Anyway, that's one option. Mm-hmm. Feel free to interrupt if I'm going on for too long about this, but I care a lot about it. The second option, or the second thing that we do and increasingly other campuses are doing, We now send out at Harvard a reading, a little booklet. It's just about 25 pages. It's not a big deal, but it's 25 pages with five very short essays presenting different perspectives about how to maintain one's individual integrity and how do you maintain your own beliefs, while at the same time being open to hearing in a cordial and welcoming way other people's beliefs. So, for instance, maybe a person who is not religious might want to listen thoughtfully to a person who is religious. That doesn't mean they have to change or convert or change their mind, but at least listen and consider what the other person's saying. And vice versa, the second person should listen to the first. We then have mixed student groups where there's some white folks and black folks, Latino folks, Asian American folks, religious folks, not religious folks, rich folks, poor folks. Groups of, say, about 25 students meet with a faculty member, like me, and we actually talk about these ideas, about ideas of free speech, about ideas of respect, about ideas of civilly disagreeing with one another, and even, you know, how hard it is sometimes to hear something you disagree with and may enrage you, but you don't shout, you never shout another person down, that sort of thing.
Hmm. We have a listener waiting to talk with us.
Great.
In Champaign on line one, let's go and talk to this caller. Good afternoon.
Hello. I know you just discussed religion as a variable, I guess, among students and I presume among teachers also. Other variables that are usually mentioned are gender, race, and social class, and I guess they're all sort of intertwined one way or another. But how would I go about asking a question about whether teachers are more inclined to choose one subject area over another? Do you see what I mean? In terms of are there more English teachers who are women than men? Are there more math teachers who are men than women? As a hypothesis, how would I phrase that question, sir? And where would I go for an answer?
Oh, I think I understand your question pretty well, and I think the answer to your question, the first answer is your hypothesis is exactly right. Now, remember, I have interviewed undergraduates, in other words, students, young students at colleges and universities, and you're asking me about math and English teachers. I'm not a world-class expert on that, but let me share with you. The first point is, yes, it's really pretty obvious to me, both from the interviewing I've done, but also from the data that I know about education, since I've worked with this for many years, that your guess is exactly right, sir, and that is different sorts of people tend to go into different kinds of fields. It probably will not stun any of the listeners, Celeste, to hear this, that there are proportionately more women who do English and history and proportionately more men who do physics and chemistry. Now, we could argue if that's good or bad or what are the consequences. That's a whole other program probably for you. But the punchline is, yes, indeed, your caller is exactly right. Now, second question, what you might ask, well, I think, sir, you might have been asking also, if I understood you, well, you know, how will we determine it and what kind of question can we ask? One of the questions that my colleagues and I did ask undergraduates, again, these are 19, 20, 21-year-old students, we asked them, what field are you majoring in and why did you choose it? And it was very, very interesting. I can share with you that there have been truly dramatic changes in what, since you mentioned both men and women, I'll pick up on your example. Men and women really are choosing different fields. For example, last year at my college, Harvard, graduated five astrophysics majors. Three were women. In the biology department, the majority of biology majors are women. Perhaps your listeners now, I'm going to blow someone's mind. I invite your listeners to guess, what proportion of the women at Harvard Medical School, I use Harvard because that's simply where I come into work every day, so forgive me for using this, the one place I know best, what proportion of all students at Harvard Medical School are women right now, this minute? Answer, 54%, the majority. Now, if you ask, what about the faculty, I'll bet most of your listeners would say, oh, they're mostly men. and your listeners would be absolutely right. But that's a change over time. And my guess is in another generation, we're going to have a whole lot of women medical school faculty. The world really is changing.
I appreciate the anecdotal evidence, which matches my own. I'm just, essentially, my second question was, where would I go? To the NCES?
Yeah, that's exactly, yes,
sir. Council of Teachers of English? Or how would I... Or write my congressman to go to the legislative reference service. What would I do?
You have a great question, and the short crisp answer, the best answer I think I can give. You actually mentioned it as one of your options there. There's something called the National Center for Education Statistics, and they have, to my knowledge, the best data on the kinds of questions you asked. You know, what proportion of English teachers in America in high schools are women? What proportions are African American? What proportions of teachers of math are, have master's degrees? Those kinds of questions. I would go always to the National Center for Educational Statistics, the acronym, of course, being NCES.
And I just write them a letter?
Yes, you would. Well, as you can imagine, I'm sitting here in a studio. I don't know off the top of my head.
But that's the way to go about it.
Yes, precisely. Just ask them your precise two or three questions, and just ask them to send you the publications that will offer the answer to your questions, and they willingly and enthusiastically will do that. I might add to your caller and to other listeners, many federal agencies, including this National Center for Education Statistics, get relatively few requests for their publications. So rather than being, irritated and put off by, oh my goodness, there's this guy from Illinois and he's troubling us for all this data, it's really quite the opposite. They're delighted to hear from you and they say, this is terrific, someone cares.
I really appreciate listening to you, sir, and I'm looking forward to reading your book.
You're very kind. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are welcome. Questions and comments, join the discussion. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Professor Richard Light. He is the author of Making the Most of College Students Speak Out. Richard Light is a professor in the Graduate School of Education and the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-WILL, and anywhere else outside the Champaign-Urbana area, 800-222-WILL. Professor Light, what advice would you have for high school students and their parents who are now beginning to think about where to go to college?
What a great question. I'm happy to share general thoughts.
Sure.
But I'm going to say two things as caveats. The first is I have my own two daughters. They went through this process several years ago of choosing which college, and I won't say where they went. But the point is they chose very wisely, and I think the overarching principle that each of the kids kept in their mind, and let me just now get away from my own kids and talk much more broadly about students at so many colleges, since I have data from 1,600 interviews. Let me focus on those instead of my own little family. The single most important thing that I would say to any young man or woman who's 16, 17, 18 years old, thinking, where might I begin to look for a good college for me? I'd say, look for a good match. That seems so important. And let me now go. I want to take a moment to answer your question, Celeste, by just pointing out a couple of choices that every young man or woman must make as they begin to think, where would I be happy at college? First, of course, we don't want to ignore money. I mean, they have to go somewhere that either they can afford or they'll get some sort of scholarship, perhaps. And I might add, often families don't appreciate. They just may not know how many universities and colleges offer remarkably generous scholarships and low-interest loans and that sort of thing, and I hope no one forgets that. But let me just again go on. The single biggest deal for me are to ask a handful of questions. I would, for instance, if some young woman who I didn't know very well came to me and said, do you have broad, generic advice that might be useful? Mm-hmm. I'd say first, well, do you think you would be happier spending the next, say, 4, perhaps 5 years of your life in a urban area or in a rural area or in a suburban area, because, you know, going to school, if I can use, why don't I use Chicago as an example? I think your listeners will know very well, going to, say, if one can, if you can get in, the University of Chicago, right in the core of the city, is a somewhat different experience just in terms of the ambience around you from going to, say, why don't I use Northwestern? And both the University of Chicago and Northwestern are somewhat different from going to the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. So here you have three different, you know, settings, and, you know, who am I to say what's right for any one young man or woman? But there's a choice. Now, let me continue. I mentioned yesterday, or we discussed yesterday at the beginning of the conversation, that I visited Bryn Mawr. What is Bryn Mawr? Bryn Mawr has 1,200 students, and they're all women. Now, are the women there happy? Oh, well, I spent a large fraction of yesterday interviewing those a number of young women, one-on-one, and it was really quite something. I mean, I only had time to interview a few, but I actually found only one, who, one young woman was not very happy. But if I interviewed perhaps, let's say, 16 of the young women there, 15 were somewhere from pretty happy to very happy. They were academically satisfied, they had formed close friendships, and when I asked, what explains why you are so happy here on this campus, they almost all said roughly the same thing, each in their own words, each slightly different. But the basic theme was, we knew we wanted to go to an all-women's college. We felt it would, we can focus our studies. There are a couple of other colleges nearby with plenty of men. That's not an issue. Haverford, Swarthmore, University of Pennsylvania. But they also said we wanted to be not in a big city, but rather near a big city. And Bryn Mawr's about a half hour outside of Philadelphia. Now, you know, who am I to judge? It's not my business to say if that's a good choice or a bad choice. If those young women are happy campers, they obviously chose wisely.
How can one, you know, this is something, too, that I know that a lot of parents are doing and a lot of students are doing with their parents. Mm-hmm. This is high school students. They're going and visiting many, many college campuses.
Yes.
In broad general terms, how do you make the best, how do you make the most of a visit to a college campus?
What, Celeste, what a great question. I love your question. Let me share with you from talking to students what they say mm-hmm. makes the most. Because, again, you know, here I could give Richard Dick Light's opinion. I say, you know, Richard Light thinks this, I think this, I think that. But why don't I, instead of saying what I think, let me tell you what the students say, because that's the power of what, you know, the one thing, if I've done one thing that's valuable here, it's actually I've got data from students. So let me share what they say. What they say is they want to make a lot of visits, and rather than have, I'm going to make a kind of a little story here. Imagine the young man or the young woman gets in the car and drives with mom or dad or both to visit a campus. So they decide they're going to visit the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, or they're going to visit, you know, who knows what, Indiana University or Notre Dame or whatever it is. You know, Wellesley College, USC, UCLA, whatever it is, and they go. It's the students, it's remarkable, the students say the parents often can't stop themselves, by that I mean can't stop themselves, the parents, from explaining to their daughter or son why a campus is good or why a campus isn't good. What the students say is they want their parents to say to them, we've already gone to college. It's up to you to make your choice. Obviously, parents should, if they think their daughter or their son is making, you know, a terrible, terrible mismatch, a terrible judgment, they should speak up. But if I can just personalize it for a moment, I remember when my wife and I went with our older daughter to visit a particular campus, it was all I could do to restrain myself from saying, this place is heaven. And my wife turned to me and she just said, remember, we've been to college. We had our chance. Now it's our daughter's chance. Well, I was put in my place, but it was very, very good advice. And the kids, the students, echo it when we interview them, when I interview them, when many others interview them. They just say, we want our parents to let us decide. You know, we have a sense where we're comfortable.
Yeah. I think it's wonderful if you can almost step apart from your parents and visit a place and have some space. And I also think from my own experience, looking back on it now, not only did I talk with my parents, I talked with other adults who'd been to college, had their shot at it, and asked them, well, you know, here's something that I saw that I was really impressed with, and here's the catalog, and here's what I'm thinking about. What do you think? And to have a number of different points of view and it just sort of other things to think about. Other people's experience was good, but at the same time, you kind of want your own space to investigate what a place is like.
Well, I agree with you, Celeste. I think what you said is right on target, and if I may even add a couple of points to what you said, one of the things that I think each young adult, you know, each young woman, young man should decide for himself or herself is, it's actually related to this question of parents, would they like to go to school close to home or would they like to go to school far away from home? One of the things that's been so striking as I've interviewed students, not only on my campus, but again on other campuses such as the, you know, the Notre Dames and the Bryn Mawrs of the world and the University of Washington's of the world, there are some students who literally are going to school a mile or two or three or four from where they grew up, and they're very happy with it. You know, they feel they've made a good choice. Others say, you know, kind of with a slightly sad look, well, I really wish I'd kind of had a little bit of a change of pace and a change of place. Actually, that's a direct quote from a recent interview I did. And then there are other students I interview who literally have come across from across the country. You know, it's interesting. Here we are in Massachusetts, where I'm sitting, you know, at Harvard. I go to work every day in Massachusetts. If you ask, where do most of our students come from? Well, the third biggest representation in terms of a state representation is they're from California, which means we have a whole lot of students, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of students coming all the way across the country to go to Harvard. Now, it's true Harvard is famous. It has a, you know, a famous name. Nonetheless, it's obvious those students either wanted to or, I would say, were willing to and had a reasonable comfort level traveling 2,500 miles away from home.
Yeah. And that's something really important to keep in mind because there are so many adjustments to make when you're 18, 19 years old in terms of leaving home to go to school, whether it's to go a few miles away or to go, you know, cross country. That's one big one. And then also, but there are so many other things to adjust to.
Yes, I agree with you, Celeste. And not only it is as you say. And again, I'll just add one of the biggest questions. Here's a concrete thing that I invite, you know, your listeners to reflect upon, because there's no right answer. It's up to each family to make this decision for themselves. Very often, sometimes for financial reasons, students end up going to college very close to home. They have, you know, something almost approaching a commuting relationship. They might live in the residence halls or the dorms of, why don't I use Loyola in Chicago as an example, because it's right in the northern part of Chicago, the city itself. Most of the students, I think, do come from the, you know, greater Chicago area, although many do live in the dorms. So on one hand, they're having the college experience living in the dorms on campus. They're not living at home. That's, you know, quite a big deal. On the other hand, they're not far from home. Now, why do I bring this up? I bring it up because each of those families, the family of such a student, has to make a decision. And that is, suppose I were the father of such a student. Well, and Uncle Harry is coming for lunch or for dinner on Sunday. Do I call my daughter, do I call my son and say, hey, want to come on home? I mean, you are just 3 miles away. You know, Uncle Harry's going to be here for dinner on Sunday. Come on home for dinner. Well, that may be a good thing. You know, if that's, in fact, what works for the family, that's wonderful. May it prosper. But for a whole lot of other families, when the parents do call the, you know, their son or daughter too often to come home because Uncle Harry's coming for dinner or some version of that, what happens is the student loses the pleasure of the full and constant engagement in campus life.
Mm-hmm. That was something that came through loud and clear in your book, Making the Most of College, and that is students talking about the importance of extracurricular activities and life on campus. And there was, well, at least one example of extracurricular activities holding students, making life better for them on campus. Once they got involved in campus life, they were likely to do better in their academic work.
Yes, it really is right. May I share with you my favorite example? There are a whole bunch in the book for your listeners if they're not familiar with this book, Making the Most of College. The way I put the book together, it's in half of it is me. In other words, I just literally wrote, here's what we learned, here's what we found, here are some suggestions. But as you know, Celeste, the other half of it is really anecdotes in the student's own words, where you have a young man or a young woman kind of telling in three or four paragraphs, literally verbatim, you know, what they said. Here was my experience when I first arrived that first week when I was so scared and nervous. And literally, I just quote what they said. Let me share with you quickly my favorite story. There's a young woman who grew up in a small town very far away from our campus. She was the first student from her family to ever go to college. She was the first student from her high school ever to go to a college like Harvard, but she had graduated right at the top of her class in her small rural high school, and she came here. And as I interviewed her, she was, I guess, already finishing her second year, her sophomore year, but it was the most wonderful interview. She told me with a big smile how when she first came, within 24 hours, she was ready to pack her bags and basically pack it in and just leave. She said, I remember, I was overwhelmed, she said. I was overwhelmed. The big city. I'd never been to a big city like this before near Boston. I was overwhelmed by the worldliness of my fellow students. I was overwhelmed even just by the big campus itself. Well, here's the nice part of this little story. The young woman then went on to say, my story probably illustrates how good advice on campus can really make a profound difference. She said, I went to see my advisor, and you know, it's a young man, maybe 26 years old, who was assigned to be this 18-year-old new arrivals from the small town's advisor. And she said, just told him the truth and said, it's only my second day here, but I don't think I'm very comfortable here. I think I'm just going to go home and the heck with it. And the advisor, quickly understanding what's happening, sizing up the situation brilliantly, said something like, well, you know, you really ought to think about, and before you leave, would you please do me a favor and give a little thought to getting involved in an extracurricular activity, just as you said, Celeste. And the young woman said, well, what do you mean? And the young advisor said, well, to the young woman, I'm so excited here, to this young woman, well, tell me, do you write? Maybe why don't you try writing for the school newspaper, the Harvard Crimson? And the young woman said, well, no, it's, you know, not really something that appeals to me. Do you sing? Would you like to try for one of the singing groups? Well, you know, no, my voice isn't that good. Well, do you play a musical instrument for the orchestra? No, I don't really play. Are you athletic? Well, frankly, no, I'm not that good at it either. I've just been kind of grinding away trying to get A's so I could go to a good college. And the advisor suddenly got a great insight, said this young woman to me. She said, he looked at me with a big smile and said, all right, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to the tryouts for the Harvard band tomorrow, and I want you to tell them you're there to hold the drum. And the young woman looked at me, and I had no idea what this young woman was talking about. She said, Professor Light, do you understand? And I said, no, I don't get it. And she said, are you aware that when you look at any college band, a kind of college marching band at halftime at the football games, there's some guy pounding, you know, banging a drum? Well, the drum, you'll notice, she said, moves along with the band, but it's a big, heavy drum. Well, who, she said, how does the drum move? She said, well, there's someone there to hold it and pull it. So, you know, she said, I didn't know any of this, but my advisor told me, and I did indeed go to the tryouts. I volunteered to be the person to hold and pull the drum. I was accepted. And she said, from that moment on, I felt a full part of the campus community. I got my campus colors, the jacket that says Harvard on it. I wore it proudly. Then I went to an away game, a football game on a different campus. I got a little bit sick. I got the flu. One of the adults, a coach, took me to the infirmary to make sure I got good medical care. Anyway, I'm making a bit of a story out of this, but the point is, this young woman was lucky enough to have an advisor on campus who quickly sized up, correctly, the situation that she, this new young woman, needed to engage with an activity on campus. Notice this has nothing to do with the sixth class in American history or, you know, the third lecture in French literature. This is just how one lives one's life outside of classes.
I've got one other caller waiting to talk with us, but we're running tight on time, so let's make it quick on both the caller's part.
Sure.
and our part. Let's go to a listener in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hi. Well, I don't know what kind of a quick answer he can give, but I was wondering if he could discuss the pros and cons of early admission, which seems to be a hot topic in articles right now, and I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
I'll try to give you a real quick answer. There's a wonderful new piece on early admissions done by one of my colleagues right here at the Kennedy School at Harvard, a young man named Chris Avery, A-V-E-R-Y. with a couple of co-authors, but Chris Avery is the main author. What he found is that applying early, I'm just going to say it blunt, straight out, and direct, applying early to college, in fact, increases the chance of admission, so that if a young man or young woman is really quite sure, they know where they want to apply, and they know where they want to go, and they're willing to, shall I use the words, put their chips on the table, because once you're admitted early decision, you really have to go there. You can't just say, oh, I changed my mind the following week. That, in fact, it is a pretty good strategy. Now, then there's a philosophical, I'll keep this short, there's a philosophical question, is this good for higher education in America? And I'm guessing perhaps that's what the caller has in her mind. My own inclination is to say, I don't think it's a great thing for higher education, because all it does is push up the pressure to make it 4 months earlier. The flip side is, you can understand how a college will say, look, young Sally or young Joe or young Harry really wants to come here. They've applied only to us. They're willing to commit to come if we take them. So let's take them.
And the pressure is on, isn't it?
It truly is on, especially among the somewhat more selective schools, both public and private.
Yeah. Richard Light, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
My great pleasure, Celeste. I'm so pleased to have the opportunity.
Take care. Professor Richard Light has been our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Making the Most of College: Students Speak Their Minds. The book is published by the Harvard University Press. Richard Light is professor in the Graduate School of Education and the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Again, Making the Most of College: Students Speak Their Minds.